Welcome to Green and Red, Scrappy Politics for Scrappy People, a regular podcast on radical, environmental and anti-capitalist politics, brought to you by Bob Bazanko and Scott Parkin.
Welcome to the Silky Smooth Sounds of the Green and Red podcast. I'm your co-host, Scott Parkin, in Berkeley, California. And as always, I am joined by...
From Nilesville, Iowa, Bob Bazanko.
And today, we're excited to be talking with Adam Johnson, who is a media analyst, co-host of the Citations Needed podcast, a very great podcast, if I might add, and then author of How to Sell a Genocide, The Media's Complicity in the Destruction of Gaza. Adam, welcome to the Green and Red podcast.
Thanks for having me on.
And just to get into it, your book lays out how corporate media, what you call left of center media, really carried a lot of water for the Israelis and for the Biden administration. Can you go into a little bit about the complicity in the destruction of Gaza that happens in that period following October 7th through the Biden administration?
It's obviously the whole premise of the book. So the book focuses on the first year because I had to give it scope, and from October 2023 to October 2024. And the idea is that this was a more sophisticated form of propaganda than your kind of usual baseline Fox News, mindless racism, pro-Israel propaganda, that it was actually something far more sophisticated and therefore needed a longer, more rich and academic research into showing how these mechanisms of propaganda work versus like your kind of baseline kind of reptile brain right-wing media, which is why the focus of the book is in what I call liberal media, not in the Rush Limbaugh boogeyman sense of the word, but in the kind of lowercase L liberal media, New York Times, MSNBC, Washington Post, which then was, now is called MS Now, your CBS, ABC News, things like that. And showed the degree to which they bought time for the White House, deflected, engaged in what I call modes of rationalization, which is where you establish that this is happening and this is that all these children are being slaughtered. For more or less 100 children a day were being killed for several months. And indeed, 20,000 children ended up within the framework of the book. It was roughly 16,000 children were killed that first year. Ultimately, the number officially is 20,000. There was probably double that, to be honest, because that doesn't include people in the rubble and people who died of preventable disease and diabetes and dialysis and all that. The book is focused on the ways in which U.S. media intervened to deflect, make excuses for, shift burdened away from the White House using various kind of clever talking points that were almost certainly whiteboarded in some room somewhere, and largely served as a court stenographer for a White House that knew very early on that this was not defensible. And they needed to provide distance between themselves and the actual manifest policy they were supporting, which was the unqualified arming of a genocide. And we can go into what those mechanisms were, what those modes of rationalization were, but they were quite sophisticated. And this is in addition to analysis with respect to the asymmetry of language. Israelis, when they're killed, are slaughtered, massacred barbarically and savagely. When Palestinians are killed, they have died passively. So we analyzed 5,000, we being me and my researchers, Thomas Birmingham and Sarah Lazar, among others. We researched 5,000 TV clips, 12,000 articles, and the data is the overwhelming animating force of the book. It is an empirical book. It is meant to be for people who are on the fence, who don't already agree with me. It's meant for kind of Israel skeptical liberals who maybe buy into some of these narratives. And I try to walk them to the water and say, here's why you're wrong. Here's why it's actually, we need a more rigorous and material analysis rather than the kind of excuse making and court gossip and kind of court psychologizing we got from most U.S. media, and explain how that role served not in creating an accurate representation of the world, but was more concerned with ameliorating cognitive dissonance and creating space between U.S. establishment and specifically the White House and the actual policies of the White House, and making liberals feel good. I think I refer to, for example, David Leonard at the New York Times, who did the daily newsletter. I refer to him as genocide SSRIs. It's like a way of getting through it until it becomes the other guy's problem, which of course it invariably did, because the White House and Harris, who later of course replaced Biden in July of 2024, wedded themselves to this genocide unconditionally. And I think that had a great, had a lot to do with what, why their election tanked. And this is borne out by polling data. It's not just my ideological assertion, because they were more committed to the axioms of Zionism and the disciplining of what they viewed as a recalcitrant Palestinian population than they were defeating Trump. And that, I think, is reflected in what happened in reporting and polling. That's kind of the outline of the book. We can get into the details of that, but that's what one can read if they read it.
From forever, the media's been supportive, kind of cheerleaders for America's wars and interventions, especially since the Cold War, Vietnam. But even within that context, Middle East, but even within that context, this seems different, like bigger and more intense and just more grotesque, really. I don't know if you agree with that, but why? Or do you think it's different and why? Is it?
I think there's a few reasons. It's always hard to compare, but certainly the amount of raw carnage and the obvious asymmetry is unprecedented. The asymmetry of the Iraq invasion was, Iraq's, even like the bombing of Iran, like at least they have a military, they have air forces, they can vaguely fight back, as we've seen in Iran especially. Whereas in Gaza, they're just people living in tents, firing these makeshift rockets if they do at all. And of course they have no air force, they have no surface to air capacity, they have no way of defending themselves. So it's every Western sort of self-styled liberal wants to view themselves as an ally of the underdog, as the ally of the little man, or at least appeal to some kind of equity or universalism, rather than being like a rote chauvinist, like a sort of Ben-Gavir who's just like, fuck them, let's kill them all. And so that tension, that contradiction was needed to be papered over and managed. And the raw nihilism of the violence, the obvious lack of any kind of credible military pretext very early on was, like you said, it was different than other mass casualty or mass genocide events. The U.S. killed 3 million people in Indochina over 12, 13 years in the 1960s and 70s. Obviously, deaths from the Iraq war ranged between 500,000 to 1 million indirectly or directly. And that, of course, was largely in many ways due to the subsequent occupation for over 10 years. And I think that this was the amount of carnage and the speed of the carnage in such a short time. You had 500-600 people being killed a day. You had one day in late October that was 1,000 people were killed in a day, which is just objectively insane. This is a population of 2 million Palestinians who live in tents, who live in makeshift homes, who prior to October 7th, of course, had no freedom of movement, no freedom of the seas, were quote unquote put on a diet, were occupied under the State Department's own definition, occupied. And so the asymmetry, I think, required a kind of more sophisticated level of dehumanization. But I think what's important to view it as is that if American, and this is why the book is called How to Sell a Genocide, it's not just a title that's meant to be provocative. They quite literally made the decision to carry out a genocide. They wouldn't have called it that. They would have said eliminating Hamas or some other such thin military pretense that nobody took seriously. And then once that decision's made, the media's job is to sell it after the fact. It's to sell reality that Biden's not budging on his unconditional support for Israel. That's the decision that's been made in Washington, in London, in Tel Aviv. And that's the choice. And our job is to make you feel good about it, is to deflect, buy time, and shift the burden onto quote unquote Hamas, right? And that there is a kind of accelerationism, I think, in our ruling class of late that has gotten more profound, which is, I think they wanted to see what they could get away with in terms of raw violence and carnage and see where that line was. Because I think especially, this is my conclusion, and as the world warms, I think we're going to see variations of Gaza. I don't think anything this intense, but variations of Gaza around the periphery of the global north, which is to say migrant crises, economic catastrophes of various things are brought about by accelerating climate change. And I do think that it's like, let's see what we can get away with was the ethos of both media and the military state. And again, I think they maybe rationalized it to themselves as saying Hamas must go because of October 7th, blah, blah, blah. But in a sense, it was like, let's see where the line is. And this is an animating ethos behind many of the ruling class's support for Trump. It's like, let's see how far we can go with the sadism and the violence and see what the degree to which the liberal institutions will absorb that or push back against that. And that, I think, was part of the calculus, which is, okay, Biden has said he's not budging. Blinken said they're not budging. There's these core dogmas and core axioms we have to assert, and we're not budging on them, which is everyone in Gaza must surrender and be duly capitulate. And we're just going to keep punishing them. And to the extent to which there's political fallout, we can manage it. And we're seeing them manage it. We're seeing them manage it today. People keep doing these things where just now, of course, Jeffries and others appointed all these pro-Israel Congress people to various positions and have doubled down on support for Israel. And people say, why are they not listening to their base? 77% of Democrats think Israel committed genocide in Gaza. Only 11% disagree. And it's, I don't want to be too jaded and savvy, but you sound like a child when you say that. They don't care what you think. What the Democratic base thinks is irrelevant. The issue is, can it be managed? Can it be massaged? Can it be co-opted with nonprofits? Can it be duly subjugated and neutralized? And the answer to that, I think, is so far has been yes. And we saw this during the vote scolding in the summer of 2024, when it was Biden's made up his mind, right? That decision's been made. And you had top progressives like, say, AOC, who basically goes out and reinforces this trolley problem logic of it's either genocide with Biden or it's genocide plus with Trump. And there's never a sense that Biden has any responsibilities, that he's responsible for anything. The burden is then shifted onto this kind of nebulous cohort of young progressive left-wing or like voters who are seen as insufficiently loyal to the Democrats. And so there's so many sophisticated mechanisms that basically neutralize public outrage and public opinion on this. And so to a great extent, it doesn't really matter. The two most powerful Democrats in the country are Chuck Schumer, who told Bret Stephens last year that his job was to, quote, keep the left pro-Israel, and Hakeem Jeffries, who is the largest recipient of AIPAC money in the House in the last cycle. Keep in mind, he ran uncontested. So even granting that in the House, he was the largest recipient in the general election. What is, to the extent to which there is popular anger and outrage over the genocide, which I think there is, and I think it's manifest, I mean, I think it's being seen in many of these primaries, what is the mechanism with which that can be expressed? So let's talk about that. You had Mamdani run for mayor of New York. All the anti-Semitism playbook was that sort of the Corbyn playbook was used on him. And it didn't have a lot of juice because he's a fucking choir boy. And he just managed to keep his nose clean. And he appoints Tisch and largely keeps his head low. And he does some anti-Netanyahu stuff, but he doesn't call out Jeffries. He doesn't really challenge that. And then you have El Said in Michigan, who's, of course, this whole Hassan Piker thing is a disciplining mechanism to chill him and others who other kind of El Said wannabes who would make opposition to Israel central to their campaign. And so you have these turnkey fake anti-Semitism scandals, which again is a playbook that we've now seen a dozen times. You have a leadership that's lockstep support of Israel. You, of course, have AIPAC's money hoes. They're spending almost $200 million on primary elections alone, which is fucking insane. Now, keep in mind, AIPAC didn't spend money directly in elections until 2022, and they really didn't do it until after October 7th. Over the last 2 years, they've spent upwards of $300 million on primaries, which is unprecedented. I know, I think AI money spent more, but AI money was usually about two AI people duking it out, like basically Anthropic picking a candidate and Google or Gemini or Meta picking a candidate and then vying for influence. But so you have this, to what extent does it matter? And this book is basically a kind of, I'm giving you more recent updates about how those systems work, but this book is about how much of those systems worked in the early months of the genocide, where the carnage was so manifestly vulgar and there was a capacity for outrage. Because one casualty of this genocide is that we no longer have capacity for outrage. We being the kind of general liberal left American public. The amount of carnage what we saw early on in the kind of white knuckling through that has made things like bombing people seeking food or bombing hospitals or bombing UN shelters where people are, we've become used to it. It's become normal. And Israel was banking on that dynamic. And so this book is about how those hand waving away and the excuse making regime was built both with its antecedents prior to October 7th and also in an ad hoc way in the early months. And we can get into details about that. What the public thinks in 250 will get you a cup of coffee at Starbucks. It's not really that important because it supposes that somehow the Democratic leadership or that our political class is somehow concerned with what voters think. And I think they are to some extent. And I think they have to feign concern on this issue. But the level of bullshitting and hand waving and wiggling off the hook is so sophisticated. And again, you already see this with these AIPAC curated lines about cutting off aid to Israel is the kind of new line they're using, despite the fact that policy originated from Netanyahu and the late Lindsey Graham. Because they need to give people a line to say on speeches, I support cutting off aid to Israel. And then you read the fine print. And what that means is I support directly funding Israel's military support. We're actually going to have Israel pay for it, which if anyone knows anything about how the Pentagon or military spending is, it's an accounting gimmick. It's all funny money anyway. It's all deficit spending anyway. It doesn't matter. and Israel is going to pay for themselves. Therefore, you're neutralizing the issue and moving on. So you have that emerging with respect to these 2028 wannabe candidates who are going to need some kind of, you know, chum to throw these kind of low information progressive voters. And then you have, of course, one bad man theory, which is we're going to pin it all on Netanyahu as if his opposition doesn't all have the same policies. So they're working on off ramps. Again, the only context in which what the Democratic base thinks on this issue will ever manifest or be meaningful would be the 2028 presidential primary. And I think what you're seeing is the ground is very clearly being laid, as I've written several times, to come up with ways of looking like you're changing on this issue without actually changing the status quo. And so, because again, this is the function of your J Streets, of your liberal Zionist institutions, of your New Yorker magazines, of your Atlantic magazines, of your New York Timeses. They're, liberal Zionism has a tremendous capacity for quote unquote reform, which is to say PR, excellent PR. And that's what they did in the early months of the genocide. There was a clear understanding that this was not sustainable, that protests were metastasizing, that's how they would view it, that especially after the Al-Ali hospital bombing on October 17th, that there was a real, the contradictions could not be sustained. And then boom, we intervene with this idea that, oh, it was an errant PIJ rocket and it's actually blood libel. Boom, we intervene with all the other editorial shifts that were made after that with respect to removing Israeli agency, and which we can get into. And every single time there was some kind of heightened awareness of the carnage and the nihilism, you had new stories come out about beheaded babies or mass rapes or name it. Al-Shifa Hospital is actually an underground Hamas command control center. The narrative,
stronghold after stronghold that you
stronghold after stronghold, the whole every city in Gaza is a stronghold. And these were tried and true tactics that had been perfected, but in many ways there were ad hoc interventions as well. Novel interventions. Hamas had never been accused of mass rape prior to October 7th. That is not something that they had ever been accused of. That was not part of their MO. It wasn't something that was part of their, you know, whatever. That has never been part of their game plan, as far as even their harshest critics would level. But you needed to sustain what was an unprecedented level of violence, heretofore unseen. Because again, the only thing remotely comparable, which in retrospect it wasn't, but at the time we thought it was 2014, Protective Edge, when Israel killed 1,500 Palestinian civilians, according to the United Nations, and including over 520 children. And that they did that in 3 days, 4 days. The level of carnage had to have a corresponding level of incitement, propaganda, and kind of lizard brain appeals to revenge, which is again why I start the book with that being the underlying kind of impetus. And that, of course, begins with the fake beheaded baby stories, which really primed the public for this level of death. And then to the extent to which it was walked back or debunked, it had already served its purpose.
To get at that, because I was thinking of that, the rapes and the beheaded baby stories, which were repeated pretty quickly, and it didn't matter. Like, how is this actually being played out in newsrooms or in editorial offices? Like, how's the decision made? Is it just pro forma? It's just in their DNA. We're going to take Israel's side. We're going to do whatever Israel says. Or is there a lot of those conspiracies and anti-Semitic tropes out there about media, yeah, and things like that?
Of course.
But how's it actually?
It's a combination of things, really. It really depends on the outlet. And some examples, you have CBS News, which is run by Sherry Redstone, who's just open pro-Israel, yeah, billionaire. That's a pretty clear-cut case of everybody knows who. In the newsrooms, especially at places like CBS News, like 60 Minutes and Face the Nation, they do have some institutional power. And in fact, one of the reasons Sherry Redstone sold Paramount and CBS, and she says this explicitly, was because she didn't really have the energy or bandwidth to really fight those institutional people in independence at 60 Minutes especially, which is why she sold it to Ellison, who of course brought in Barry Weiss to fire everybody and discipline them. In other instances, it's a combination of fidelity to kind of the U.S. military consensus, the U.S. elite consensus, that is not so much a commitment to Zionism per se. A lot of times it is just Zionism. It's just a support for Israel. It's obviously very generational. A lot of old people, it doesn't matter if you're Jewish or whatever, it's irrelevant. You're just going to be a Zionist. That's just the MO of people who in their 60s and 70s who run these newsrooms. They don't really challenge it or question it. They don't really think about it. It's just in the DNA of their worldview, especially after 25 years of a war on terror, which is obviously what this was, which is what this was very quickly positioned within. So you had a kind of turnkey framework And in many instances, it was corporate cowardice. It was pressure from these Zionist crybully groups like the ADL and others who have basically made a art of weaponizing liberalism against itself by framing it as anti-Semitism. Again, this term that kind of chills speech and everyone gets scared and what's going on. And then, which is, of course, has been utterly stripped of any meaning in terms of popular usage. And so I'll give you one example. So in the book, we detail the opening hours of the attack on MSNBC. So at the anchor desk is Ali Valshi, who had worked for Al Jazeera, among others, because it's Saturday morning. So he's kind of, I mean this with all due respect, it's the B team, right? And then he brings on Ayman Mojaddin, who had lived in Gaza for several years, was present during Protective Edge in 2014. And as the attack unfolds on that morning, they start to give context. They start to explain what happens, like why this would happen. Why would there be thousands of Palestinians pouring out of Gaza? It's the world's largest open air prison. They give some context. It's occupied territory. 75% of the people in Gaza are either themselves refugees or orphans or the children of refugees or orphans from 67, et cetera. The sort of ethnic cleansing of Israel, of Palestinians. And all hell breaks loose. So it's the first, and since I believe last time, that Comcast corporate ever directly intervened in MSNBC, which is now MS Now. They call in Cesar Conde and Rashida Jones, the head of NBC and MSNBC respectively, and they say, never do that again. So you have Comcast directly saying, you can't provide context. Context is equivalent to Hamas propaganda or terrorism apology, or is, of course, they would frame it as anti-Semitism, which is to say, providing context for why people would be mad at Israel. And the message is received loud and clear. And then on October 9th, and this was confirmed by a source I had in MSNBC, because of which I'm sure you're not shocked to imagine that there's a lot of people who want to talk who work there. They bring in Martin Fletcher, longtime NBC News correspondent, Middle East correspondent, who himself had been in the IDF, had family in the IDF. And he has a company-wide conference call with MSNBC and NBC News where he spouts off every single Zionist cliche in the book. Palestinians aren't real. They're invented by Arab armies in 1967. Jews are the real Palestinians. And when Israel left Gaza, they left behind greenhouses, all blah, 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 blah. And so you don't have to be a rocket scientist or a brain surgeon to figure out what you're supposed to say, what you're not supposed to say at MSNBC. And this is reflected in the coverage quantitatively based on our data analysis, which is to say, it's almost never talked about. To the extent to which it is talked about, it's framed as they buy into the whole Biden is secretly working on a ceasefire nonsense to buy time for the White House. And they're obviously a very partisan network, which is a huge dynamic here we can get into. But you occasionally will have some bleeding heart segment here and there. Obviously, supposed progressives like Rachel Maddow and Chris Hayes have nothing to say of substance on this. But again, even the bleeding heart stories are always framed as either natural disasters or they completely remove Biden's role. There's no real sort of political call to action. I talk about this in chapter 4, the natural disasterification of Gaza, because you have to check the box. You can't ignore it, but it's definitely a box checking exercise. And the only real media personality at MSNBC who's good on this topic, like not great, but better than the baseline, is Joy-Ann Reid, who of course is later fired for what she says was her coverage of Gaza. Of course, you have Morning Joe, who has a 3-hour block every morning spouting the most racist, violent, anti-Palestinian claptrap. Of course, Meet the Press never has a Palestinian guest. The Morning Joe never has a Palestinian guest. And all the 3 years of genocide, this is not just the first year, but he has still not had one. And you have Joe Scarborough, who's the most dyed-in-the-wool Zionist on cable TV. And he speaks about Israel in first-person plural. We do this, we believe that. He pledges fidelity to Israel multiple times during our survey period. And that's how you get liberals to get on board. Liberals listen to MSNBC. What MSNBC says matters. It creates the acceptable balance of discourse. And it worked. And CNN had a similar intervention where their corporate heads issue statements after October 7th, 9/11-ifying it. We stand against these barbaric attacks. The word civilization is used on MSNBC and CBS a total of 150 times. So there's a sense of we're the civilized ones, we and the Zionists and the Israelis. And then there's these kind of faceless Asiatic hordes, and to the extent to which we humanize them, it's mostly they're just passive victims, and it's ultimately Hamas's fault anyway. Mark Thompson, the CEO of CNN, issues a memo on October 26th demanding that any mention of violence in Palestine, death counts in Palestine, any kind of horrific war crimes, even if they're touched on, you have to editorially and by definition preface it with the death count from October 7th. So everything has to be framed as defensive. It doesn't matter how long this goes on for, by the way. And they still do it today. It's almost been 3 years. And they still just If they butcher 15 children, it's in response to the Hamas attacks from fucking 3 years ago. So they have kind of infinite grace and infinite legitimacy to administer violence against the population in Gaza. And the inverse is not true. The October 7th attacks are not said to be in relation to or in response to the 40 children Israel killed in Palestine from January 1st of 2023 to October 6th of 2023, which was 40, which is actually roughly the amount of children who died on October 7th, or the 400 plus Palestinians who were killed in the West Bank and Gaza from January 1st to October 6th of 2023. To say nothing, of course, of the siege, to say nothing of the open air prison dynamic, to say nothing, of course, the 500 plus children who died 9 years prior in Protective Edge. So history has to begin on October 7th. It is the beginning of time. It is the Big Bang. There's asking what happened before October 7th is like asking what's north of the North Pole. It doesn't exist. And this is reflected in the coverage where context is repeatedly cracked down on or omitted or doesn't exist. And so Palestinian violence, therefore, if there's no history, if there's no context, if there's no secular or political grievances that are legitimate or semi-legitimate, what's the only explanation? They're just mindless jihadists. They just hate Jews, right? They're mindless anti-Semites, what Joe Biden calls the ancient hatred, which is a hell of a coincidence that, you know, the religion on the flag of the country, you know, the religious symbol on the flag of the country that dispossessed them of all their lands happens to be the one they happen to just hate randomly out of all the gin joints and all the towns in all the world, right? Just bad luck. And that becomes the narrative that they're just mindless anti-Semites, which again, horrible. What are the odds? And therefore, they don't have any story. They don't have a narrative. And if you don't have a narrative, you don't have a story, what do you have? You have a kind of ISIS-like entity. But of course, ISIS was a foreign-backed mercenary army that had no political legitimacy or constituency in the populations it conquered. It was backed by Saudi and UAE and Qatari money. It, of course, was not comprised of people from the places they conquered, more or less. I think there was a handful of them. And they were well-paid mercenary. Hamas is of Gaza. They are Palestinians. Its leader died fighting. They kept talking about their Sinwar. They talked about they were in some hotel in Qatar. Studies show he hadn't eaten in 3 days. So again, regardless of what one thinks of Hamas, Hamas is indigenous to Gaza. They are Palestinian. But that looks awkward and bad for a supposed liberalism that prides itself on backing the little man. And so they got indexed as Hamas, as I detail in the first two chapters. This is why this term is used over and over again by everyone from Biden to Lloyd Austin to Emmanuel Macron. It's used hundreds of times in MSNBC and CNN, according to our study, which is why the kind of ISIS and Hamas narrative had to be reinforced, because they really needed to use the blunt instrument of kind of Islamophobia. Again, they never mentioned that Hamas fights ISIS in Gaza. Their ideological and religious project is completely different. Hamas, of course, has very warm relations with Shia. They're funded by a Shia government, despite the fact that they, of course, are Sunni. They don't mention the fact that to the extent to which there is ISIS in Palestine, it is ISIS, these ISIS-linked gangs that are backed by Benjamin Netanyahu. And this is not a theory of mine. It is confirmed by Haaretz and other Israeli media that ISIS-linked gangs receive funding and arms from Israel to undermine Hamas and to steal aid from Palestinians. And all of this, of course, is just not talked about. It is just not mentioned on cable news or in mainstream media. You are given this very kind of turnkey, racist, cheesy narrative of Asiatic hordes. And this is why you see an over-reliance on terms like barbaric and savage, which are terms used exclusively for Palestinian violence on October 7th in particular. By definition, Israel can kill 20,000 children, and by definition can never do so barbarically or savagely. It is only a term reserved for the killing of Israelis. And these terms, barbaric and savage, of course, have their origins in 19th century style Victorian racism and colonialism. They are meant to call upon and draw upon certain images. And again, how Israel managed to murder upwards of 100,000 people, kill hundreds to 100,000 people, maim tens of thousands of children, and not once commit a massacre, not once commit a slaughter, and never act in a manner that could be described as barbaric and savage, is beyond me. I don't think any reasonable, rational liberal could look at that data that I provide and think that this is at all fair or equitable. And in fact, Honest Reporting, which is one of these Orwellian-named Zionist bully groups that tries to bully the media into being more pro-Israel, they critiqued my article where I published these findings in The Intercept, and they couldn't find any problems with my data because the data is incredibly conservative. It is incredibly rigorous. It was fact-checked by two fact-checkers. A ton of resources went into making sure it was rigorous. We published all the citations on GitHub. It's all for, you can go try to recreate it yourself. And so they couldn't find any problems with the data. So what do? They say, you know what? The media was biased in favor of Israel, but that's because Israel's good and Palestinians are evil. So it's this kind of tautology is really all they have. And in fact, Jody Ruttenberg, who had worked at the New York Times for years, and in fact is back working at the New York Times, Al Jazeera confronted her with my initial findings, which were published in The Intercept in January 2020, about 2 years before the book was published, and said, how do you explain these discrepancies? How do you explain the fact that Palestinian deaths are never described as savage or barbaric or massacres or slaughters, whereas Israeli deaths are? And she gave the same kind of circular answer. She says, well, they're different because Israelis are killed up close by machine gun fire, whereas bombs kill Palestinians, which is not true, by the way. Israel killed Palestinians up close all the time. So that's just not true. And in fact, of course, there's the UN's evidence of mass child killings indicates that they deliberately used Palestinian children as basically target practice at a large scale because they don't have anything else. Because they don't have a rational, universalist, liberal explanation. Because really what they want to say is, look, I'm a Zionist. I believe in this rather goofy idea that Jews from Santa Monica and New York and London have some unique privilege to this land on Palestine over Palestinians who've lived there for dozens of generations, right? A kind of patently absurd idea, right? Because Jews generically, of course, have always been in Palestine. They've been in there for thousands of years. But the idea that they have some kind of transnational diasporic land claim from 1500, 2000 years ago is clearly insane. But they can't just say that because it sounds chauvinist and it sounds illiberal and it's kind of gauche to be like, look, I'm a Zionist. I support it, you know, Jewish supremacy and sovereignty in Palestine over those who have lived there. That kind of sounds tacky. So they have to invent these faux universalist narratives, and the load-bearing framework, the load-bearing epistemology for this reconciliation of liberalism with Zionism is this concept of a war on terror. That there's this discrete, unique thing called terrorism that is transnational and is completely religiously motivated. And we have to defeat this abstraction. And this serves as a way of papering over the obvious contradictions in these self-styled progressives and self-styled liberalism with this obviously absurd ethno-supremacist colonial project. And in fact, there was an Australian Zionist paper called The Jewish Independent that criticized, because my book was banned in Sydney and then was unbanned. There's a whole story there. We can get into that.
We have questions about that.
And then on the website, she spouts all these tropes about Palestinians being responsible and how they bombed their own hospital. And then in the corner of the webpage is a land acknowledgement. They're like, we're on indigenous land in Australia. And I'm just like, this is a perfect distillation of liberal Zionism.
I got to say that the liberal Zionists I know, even here in the Bay Area, are all like, Jews are indigenous to the area from 6,000 years ago. It's just like a,
It's one of those
things that's not rooted in any history.
It's superficially true that there's always been Jews in the Levant, but there's been dozens of ethnicities and religions in the Levant. If they all made land claims, not only that land claims, but supremacist and sovereign land claims, that would obviously be unworkable. We would have to kick the Turks out of Turkey, the Anglo-Saxons out of England. This is ridiculous. The whole idea that there's some kind of secular humanist logic to why we need to have one specific group in the Levant, again, a place in the world that has always had a bunch of different ethnic and religious diversity, is clearly insane. Obviously, it's not a rational or liberal or humanist worldview. So yeah, that's what they want to say is, look, Israel exists, everyone's pot invested in it. Yes, it's a bit of a kind of ridiculous artifact from a spasm of hyper-nationalism in the late 19th century. Yes, it was created as a kind of outpost of US imperialism, but we're all committed, and so we just got to kind of keep killing Palestinians until they submit or just kind of go away. But they can't say that.
Yeah.
They can't say that because, it's illiberal.
One question I have is, within these liberal media outlets, institutions, how much dissent are we seeing within people who work there? How much are people talking? I hear about people being fired. I don't actually hear a lot about people resigning in protest.
A lot of people being fired. A lot of people resign in protest. I would say that one of the most common situation was people just got moved off a desk or kept their head low. And then they had a kind of, I'm going to change things from the inside mentality. This is typical. But a lot of it was disciplined using very lazy racism, to be quite honest. People ask me, what was the biggest way this was enforced? And I wish I had some sophisticated Chomskyan model, but really it was just like, oh, you're Arab or Muslim? Yeah, you're not working on this. You're not covering this. And if to the extent to which we would let you, you have to signal your fidelity to the premises of Zionism. So a lot of it was just lazy racism, Arab, even like South Asian, or even if long as you were like vaguely Muslim coded, especially if you were younger, you were just removed from the beat, or you would give pitches at pitch meetings and just ignored. You would have your work heavily censored by a pro-Israel editor. That was very common. We heard that a lot. A lot of times it's generational as well, because there was a lot of pushback within a lot of newsrooms. But typically management was older, more Zionist, and they would just say no. And then again, you learn very quickly, like a rat in a maze, you learn which walls electrocute you, and you learn very quickly where you're supposed to go and where you're not supposed to go. So it's less a direct top-down edict. It's this person puts their head up and it gets chopped off, and then it takes about 5 seconds before you realize what you're not supposed to say.
And how much there's an ideological element here, both with Zionism and liberalism and allegiance to the Biden-Harris administration. How much of it is also driven by advertisers, donors, that sort of thing as well?
To the extent to which it's driven by advertisers, it's because advertisers are scared of the ADL shakedown operation. Because the ADL is very good at targeting advertisers under the auspices of fighting hate. And this is the kind of milieu the ADL has operated in for years. And keep in mind that Jonathan Greenblatt, the head of the ADL, effectively has a standing post at Morning Joe and on CNN on Jake Tapper's show. He's on there all the time. I make a joke that he sleeps in the green room at MSNBC.
The editor of the Atlantic was an IDF prison guard.
Yeah. This is pretty typical. Our media is run by people who have loyalty to Israel for various reasons, either because of their fidelity to U.S. imperialism dictates, or because they have an emotional attachment to Israel, or themselves have been in the IDF. And so that's going to be reflected in the coverage. And Ta-Nehisi Coates writes about this in The Message when he worked at The Atlantic, where he, I think, somewhat effectively, or with great effect, if you will, apologizes for his early writing on Zionism at The Atlantic, where he compares it to the Black struggle and does this facile kind. And they love this shit at The Atlantic, by the way. If you can sell Zionism as anti-racism, they will fucking publish you. And he says, look, I learned very early on that all my managers and editors were in the tank for Israel. I knew how to get ahead and I feel ashamed about it. So I wrote this shit I half believed. Obviously, I have these propaganda junkets people go on. Dozens of members of the media go on these propaganda junkets where they give you this manipulative claptrap about the Holocaust being somehow in continuity with the Palestinian liberation struggle. Again, they just project all of Germany's and Prussia's crimes and Bavaria's crimes onto fucking Palestinians who are like, what the fuck did I do? Again, because you have to create this idea that they're just that the extent to which people would oppose an ethno-supremacist Jewish state in Palestine, it's only because they hate Jews. It can never be like, I don't know, I lived here and my family was kicked out and we've been in a refugee camp for 3 generations. It always has to have this sectarianism to it. And we can talk about the ways in which US media, largely due to the prompting from groups like the ADL, always frames it in the most sectarian way possible. Palestinians or those who support Palestine are never permitted to have universalist, secularist, or left-wing commitments. They're always driven by some explicit or implicit or innate or conscious or subconscious hatred of Jewish people, like by definition, because otherwise you have to actually debate the merits, and on merits, there's no real defense. So it's just anti-Semitism. And so the ADL got really good at bullying these groups and these organizations. And in 2020, actually, I co-wrote a piece with my partner, Sarah Lazar, for In These Times, because ADL had partnered with Color of Change and they were going to fight hate on Facebook. And I knew some people at Color of Change. We had actually had them on my podcast. And I'm like, what the fuck are you doing partnering with ADL, this Israel lobbying group? And they're very good at ingratiating themselves into these kind of progressive liberal or political coalitions. And now they don't as much anymore. We could talk about that. But when you frame opposition to Zionism as a form of racism and hate, it is so effective on liberals, because the worst thing you can call a liberal is a bigot, right? Nobody wants to be an anti-Semite. Nobody wants to be a bigot. And I think that's good. I think we should want to not want to be those things. The problem is that these terms have been completely stripped of any meaning, and they're just these mindless bludgeons, as we've seen time and time again, that are used to indemnify Israel from substantive criticism. And what they always say is, you can criticize Israel, but blah, blah, you can't really question its sort of premises, its axioms. And which is another way of saying you can engage in this facile Netanyahu bad stuff, but you can't really question the premise of their specific ethno-supremacist land claims, which again, I think are on their face quite silly or indefensible, or at the very least, they're very illiberal. And that is what they're good at doing. And so I think the corporate pressure was not really that profound. I think to the extent to which it was mostly because they just didn't want to get because there's no comparable Palestine advocacy group. There's been some attempts in the last couple of years to have an AIPAC for Palestine, but their resources and their influence and their money is just not remotely comparable. Jake Tapper text messages with Jonathan Greenblatt. They're friends. You're not going to get that. Where are you going to get that in fucking any other outlet? That's just how the cookie crumbles in terms of ideological commitments. And then, of course, you do have a kind of broader commitment to U.S. imperialism and military worship, and U.S. militarism was front-loaded on this. So it wasn't just a kind of emotional attachment to Zionism or cultural attachments to Zionism, whether they be Christian Zionist or Jewish Zionist. It was also a broader fidelity to this kind of concept of the West and the war on terror and these other kind of turnkey frameworks we've been primed with over the last few decades.
One of the, I think, to me, the most bizarre things is that it's opened the door, this complicity by liberals has opened the door for Tucker Carlson and Candace Owens and Marjorie Taylor Greene and Thomas Massie, who probably are anti-Semitic, to assume this mantle. And I share their stuff approvingly, even though I know they're fucking crazy, right? But, and J.D. Vance has said things that would have gotten them kicked out of Columbia University. How is, just from a political standpoint, and if you are Schumer Jeffries, or I really do believe in that Israel's more important to them than their own voters at this point, because of course, the stuff they're doing. Like, how do they, don't they even see that politically this is self-destruction?
They want to elevate that, right? They want to elevate Tucker Carlson as the voice of anti-Israel because it plays in their sandbox of sectarianism, and they want to play in the sandbox of sectarianism. There's a reason why Ted Cruz.
Most people agree with Tucker Carlson.
I'm saying, but there's a reason why Ted Cruz will sit down with Tucker Carlson and not say a liberal critic of Israel like Ta-Nehisi Coates. There's a reason why Jonathan Greenblatt elevates the right-wing Israel critics, because their criticism, and again, I'm not going to scold anyone who takes help where you can get it. The Palestine cause should take help where it can get it. If it can erode support among Republicans, all the better. But I will say that their criticism is very skin deep. And what's funny is actually you listen to Tucker Carlson, he's a liberal Zionist. He reaffirms Israel's right to exist. He reaffirms their right to self-defense all the time. So he's like a sort of anti-Semitic liberal Zionist. He doesn't actually oppose Israel in any meaningful sense. And the reason why that is because his fundamental project, aside from polishing the turn of J.D. Vance, and he sold Trump three different times as this anti-war, anti-deep state guy, right? And he's clearly setting up J.D. Vance for that same pitch for the fourth time in a row. So Lucy's going to kick the football for the fourth time, right? And there's an online cohort of hardcore groupers who that's their thing. And they believe that. And he's the guy who directs them into sheepdogging for Trump and then now J.D. Vance. But it's a very skin deep criticism because it's about preserving American innocence. If you listen to him or you listen talk to Joe Kent, who is, of course, the State Department designee under Trump, you would think that Trump was this agency-free, like otherwise pure and righteous man who has been manipulated by the evil Jews in his administration. That's the narrative they give when they give their figures. Now, where did we see a version of this for a year? On MSNBC, right? Biden was working on a ceasefire, but was always being usurped by Netanyahu. And of course, it wasn't put in.
Bernie Sanders says that.
Yeah, and it wasn't put in those kind of sectarian wink-wink terms that Tucker Carlson did, but it's effectively the same narrative, which is about preserving American innocence. And the key thing, if anyone can take away something from this book, is that this was an American project that Americans agreed to engage in on behalf of the ideology of Zionism, which is sometimes in tension with, but is fundamentally an extension of U.S. liberal imperialism, which itself, again, which has its origins in British imperialism. And indeed, The Zionist philosophy of mass slaughter at 100-1 is an extension of what the British imperialists called the moral effect, which is you have to use extreme violence on civilian populations to discipline them when they fight back. You have to let them know that you're the colonial overseer and you have to engage in mass punishment. So none of these currents are particularly new. Now, Zionism, because of its relationship to a kind of the Jewish religion and the Jewish middle class in the West is somewhat different, right? It's not quite like South Africa. But it has basically the same core components and the same core components of other of colony states like a Rhodesia and others. And like that very clearly, I think, is what Tucker Carlson and these other Israel critics on the right are primarily concerned with, which is preserving the U.S. military so they can go blow up China or commit some other kind of great war against some other enemy of communism or some such. And the reason why I'm skeptical, and call me cynical, aside from the fact that he puffed up Trump as some anti-war guy for three different elections, despite the fact that, of course, Trump is just as violent and imperialist as Biden, is that he, for 2 years, he was crying to pull out of Afghanistan, especially when Trump signed that deal with the Taliban in 2020. And then in August of 2021, Biden pulls out of Afghanistan, and Tucker Carlson spends the next year, it really hasn't stopped since, doing a Benghazi treatment of Biden. Surrender, we pulled out, left the military, stabbed in the back, kind of Rambo bullshit. And it's so, do I think his anti-war, do I think he'll just do that in the event that anyone, I just don't trust him. He's repeatedly shown he will take a kind of fake anti-war position, but he doesn't follow through. That said, do I think the broader ideological and rhetorical erosion of Zionism's position within the Republican Party helps liberate Palestine in the long term? Probably, but again, I think it's you have to be careful because I do think there's so much grifting out there right now. Obviously, there's some broad popular anger about Gaza, and there's a lot of people who will come and either A, pick your pockets, or B, sheepdog you into what I view as a false path of anti-Zionism on the right, which is to say, go ahead, please.
Doesn't Carlson's, whether it's contrived or genuine or not, and I don't think it's genuine either, but in the absence of anything coming from liberals or the left, not liberals, let's say, it has real meaning. I know a lot of Arabs who are Tucker Carlson fans.
I get it. I preface my statement by saying that.
I know, but there's a political question here too, that Jeffries and Schumer are content with that. I'm thinking 2028.
They're not just content with it, they want it.
Yeah. So in 2028, essentially somebody, a Carlson type figure, with all the fucking crazy ideas that he has about immigration and gays and conspiracies and all that, who's at least rhetorically anti-Israel, could very easily become president.
I tend to agree, but I think it would have to be Tucker. I think if Tucker tries to polish the turd of J.D. Vance, I don't think anyone's going to buy that. Vance has been on the forefront of promoting the Iran war, despite his constant leaks to the New York Times insisting that he's doing such and such behind the scenes, which again is literally the same playbook Biden used. And so, yes, I think that's a risk. But look, there was just a block the bombs vote in the Senate, right? An actual decent bill to block the bombs. And it was one of these performative DOA bills where like Democrats voted for. Like, Cory Booker voted for it. Does anyone think Cory Booker would really support it if it was actually? But it got zero Republican support. These bills routinely get zero Republican support in Congress. The only support they got was Ted Massey, who, of course, AIPAC took a seat away from him. So I don't know. I don't see that reflecting in the actual people in Congress. And until it does, nothing more than kind of a niche product for a very small subset of Republican voters. But again, I think you take wins where you can get them. And like, I'm not going to be too precious about that. I don't think someone has to have my precise left-wing anti-imperialist orientation, but I will say that I'm a socialist. I at my deepest core part of my bones, I am not a sectarian person. I don't believe in that can ever be the foundation of solidarity. I think it'll always be, again, Tucker Carlson demagogues and his racism against Muslims, obviously all the time. We called Iraqis monkeys. And I think any kind of solidarity with Palestine has to be rooted in a universalism and a humanism for it to ever be remotely sustainable. And that's just my core ideology. That said, again, I'm not going to go out of my way to scold people who find some kind of hope in that or willing to latch on to that or share that with their friends on social media, because I get that not everyone has the privilege of being as precious as I am. But you could waterboard me for 2 months and I'll never view this in those terms, because I think that's always going to be skin deep and always going to immediately just turn on whoever, because you can't build solidarity based on salvaging another colonial state, which is the United States' own myth of innocence and purity. Right? We would otherwise be a benevolent empire of yeoman farmers if it wasn't for those dastardly neocons. The U.S. killed, again, millions of people in Indochina, killed 10% of Korea's population in wars that had very little to do with Zionism. So I don't buy that narrative. I think Zionism is simply an accelerated, more modern version of these pre-existing colonial relations. And so Tucker's never going to really talk about that, because that's obviously undermines his own
narrative. Isn't he important though in juxtaposition to what you just written about, the absence of any kind of liberal?
Correct. You know, this is a point that has to be emphasized.
That's why he's important.
If there was any meaningful anti-Zionism in the Democratic Party, Tucker would have no constituency.
Exactly. That they've created the Democrat, the liberal.
Of course. No, his to the extent to which he has any.
And yes. Owens and all of them. Yeah.
Because there isn't really leadership on the progressive left on this issue.
It's all Netanyahu. That's all you get from Bernie Sanders.
Yeah, I know. He's vaguely moved away from that rhetoric, but there's nothing. He doesn't pass those.
He said it again last week.
He doesn't ask those deeper existential delegitimizing questions. That
and AOC is
AOC is all box checking. It's like,
yeah,
because like no one's reading on it.
As right. credibility, it's that's my fear.
I mean, no, I completely agree.
As a socialist, he's an asshole. But
the extent to which he has any credibility or he gets those viral clips or gets traction is because there's absolutely no leadership from the progressive left. Ro Khanna tries to do it, but he can't help himself. He reverts back to this.
Yeah.
This Israel's a right to defend itself, Hamas terrorism, these kind of like brainless liberal Zionist cliches because he doesn't want to offend J Street and these other center left discipline actors. Whereas Tucker just doesn't give a fuck. He's there to gin up ratings and outrage. And so he asks deeper, more interesting questions on that. But again, it's just, I think I go back to this FAIR study from 2003 that analyzed the voices to oppose the Iraq war. And I think it was something like 293 voices. Only three of them that were seen on network news and the Sunday morning shows were left-wing anti-war voices. Whereas Pat Buchanan had been on there a dozen times. He was basically 4X. Like, you want to elevate Pat Buchanan as your Iraq war critic, right? If I'm a Zionist or a neocon or in that orientation, because it's such an easier person to negotiate with because it doesn't appeal to liberal values. It doesn't appeal to universalism. And so you can always frame your critics as bigots or driven by, because again, if I'm like a liberal curious person watching Tucker and I'm like, he's making a lot of sense on Israel. And then he flips the page and starts talking about Haitians eating cats. You have to ask yourself, is he recruiting the right to the cause of Palestine liberation? Or is he recruiting people angry about Palestine into being mad at immigrants? And I think it's mostly the latter. That's my cynical opinion.
We're getting towards the end of the time.
Well, I have a couple more questions. So
I have one more too.
Okay.
My question is around your book getting banned in Sydney. Just to touch on that story. We have actually some ties to Australia. We've done shows on Australia with Australians. Okay.
Interesting.
Wondering if you could just give us a little bit of a quick rundown on that.
So a pro-Israel outlet in Sydney reported, I think on August, I don't want to say 15th or something. I think I was in San Francisco when the story broke. I was doing a book tour in the Bay Area.
That's where I met you.
Indeed. And that the book had been removed from the shelves and Waverley Council, which is, I don't exactly know how the federalism works in Australia, but I'm getting a sense of it. And it's a public library, and they took the book off the shelves. And the story was they took the book off the shelf because a, quote, Bondi survivor asked it to be removed because it was offensive, because the word genocide was offensive to them. And it was supposedly on this hot new item display or something. But it wasn't just in the library. It was being promoted by the library. Now, I tweeted about it. I wasn't going to make a stink about it because there's nothing more obnoxious in the world than a kind of white middle-class free speech martyr. I think I just like this is an annoying posture to have. But I was like, hey, their logic for taking this down is incredibly racist and stupid because obviously a Palestinian can't just walk in and say, I find Alan Dershowitz's book offensive, take it down now, and they would immediately take it down. It's a privilege only afforded to, but obviously it was near the Bondi Beach attack. This is the same area. So the narrative seems semi-plausible. For the record, I don't really buy it, or at least I need to see evidence of it, is what I'll say. And then it was reported on by The Guardian. It was reported on by the Sydney Morning Herald, which allowed someone from AJAC, which is one of these pro-Israel crybully organizations, to libel me as an anti-Semite, or so I think he said I was dehumanizing the Jewish population or some other such libelous claim. And then I took offense to the coverage. The Guardian story was mostly good, but the Sydney Morning Herald and the Independent in the UK just took at face value this narrative that some Bondi survivor saw it and had it taken down. Again, if you know anything about how Zionist crybully campaigns operate, they always put the most sympathetic face forward, and it's usually never the whole story. I currently have a Freedom of Information request into the library. I should update you. Sorry. As of yesterday, the book has now been brought back to the shelves. The idea that you can just unilaterally take down a book upon a request, and then you have to have a campaign with 2,800 signatures and a bunch of media coverage to put it back, really just shows that they were just trying to take it down and hope no one noticed, or at least do celebration in their own internal Zionist media, and then the rest of us wouldn't notice. But they got a lot of pushback, obviously. And this is in the context, of course, it's important to understand is that there's been a huge free speech crackdown in Australia since Bondi. Now, what's important to understand about Bondi is that it had nothing to do with Palestine. It was an ISIS-inspired attack. The attackers allegedly made some offhanded reference to Zionists, but we've seen no evidence of this. And of course, the attackers themselves had no history with Palestine solidarity. They themselves were not Palestinian. They had no relation to Palestine solidarity. But desperately, the pro-Israel lobby wants to tie Bondi with Palestine solidarity and Palestine activism so they could suppress and silence Palestine activism. And they are duly doing that. In fact, they've changed the local and federal laws to that effect. And there's great writing on that, which one can look up. And so this exists within the context of a broader crackdown on pro-Palestine speech. And I have a few theories about what really happened. To the extent to which this was a trial balloon to see if they could get outright book bans wouldn't surprise me, or at least make them so they're not displayed at libraries, but put in the back in the kind of grimy corner where you have to seek it out, but they're not, it's not part of the culture, as it were. And so they apparently yesterday announced, although I think the council has not officially confirmed this yet, The Guardian, for whatever reason, could not get them to officially confirm it, but people in the area reported they could check out the book. And so I sent emails to the council, being in the library officials and library management, saying, can you give me a sense of the timeline here? Was it some Bondi survivor who just happened to see my book and issued a complaint? Because The Independent and the Sydney Morning Herald reference, quote, multiple complaints. So there's other complainers. And I'm curious to know who those complainers were and if they preceded or were after the supposed Bondi survivor complaint. Because I sense it's not the whole story. Again, having just written a book on these things, I have a sense of how the formula works. And so they never got back to me. So I issued what called an informal freedom of information request at the advice of someone who answered the phone at the Waverly Council, which I just kind of called in the middle of the night here and, of course, daytime there. And that was about 5 days ago. So I'm waiting on word of this freedom of information request. I requested any mention between library staff or any emails from library staff with my name in it or the book's name in it and names of the other Zionist cry-bully organizations. Because I'm pretty sure that they were the origin of this, but I could be wrong. Could have just been a perfectly happenstance and organic episode, but I've never seen it. There's been no evidence. Supposedly there was some Facebook post where this Bondi survivor claim that's what happened, but The Guardian couldn't find the Facebook post. So I think it's important to get to the bottom of it because I think it's important to understand how these things work. It's not, they've silenced various professors and other speech in Australia, and it's always framed as Bondi survivor because clearly, again, the liberal is going to hear Bondi survivor and your instinct is going to be to defer to that because obviously that's a horrific thing to have experienced and one doesn't want to be heartless and one wants to be sensitive to people's, but again, what that has to do with Palestine is lost on me because it's completely irrelevant. And to the extent to which these were ISIS nutcases, again, the only supporters of ISIS in the region are either Gulf countries or allies of Israel or Netanyahu, who funds ISIS-linked gangs in Gaza. Hamas executes and imprisons ISIS members. So I don't know what that has to do with the price of tea in China. But of course, in their mind, it's all the same, right? But why our media has to indulge that is if it's somehow a legitimate perspective and not a just glib and racist ideological worldview, I don't know. And I think that one must start to demystify and pick apart these narratives, these PR playbooks, and stop taking all this at face value. We don't have time and we don't have the resources to accept these mopey, sectarian, manipulative, liberal, targeted narratives like around anti-Semitism and sensitivity and all this other crap. It's all bullshit. They're doing it to Hassan Piker. Completely taking a comedy made that's completely unobjectionable and banal and has been made by Ezra Klein and has been made by Dana Bash, a very generic statement about how Israel's violence makes Jews in the West unsafe, completely distorted it and manipulated it as part of this PR campaign. And then the liberal response is always freedom of speech and all this other kind of safe tracks. And I think we got to stop that. We have to demystify the playbook. We have to break the fourth wall. We have to talk about how the Corbyn playbook is a playbook. None of this is in good faith. None of these Zionist cry bullies give a shit about anti-Semitism. There's a reason why they never criticize Elon Musk, despite the fact that he traffics in anti-Semitic tropes all the time and talked about great replacement theory and Nazi rhetoric. It's because he's a supporter of the ADL and a supporter of Israel. Anti-Semitism got nothing to do with any of this. This is about the promotion and the punishment of Israel's interest and the defense and the silencing and subjugation of those who question its full sovereignty between the river and the sea. That is all this is about. So to the extent to which this Waverly episode can help further edify the public as to this playbook, I'm going to pursue that aggressively. I have lawyers in Australia who are going to aid me if there is an attempt to prevent the release of this timeline information. Because I don't believe the story. Again, it could end up being true. You never know. I just think it's a little pat and a little manipulative and probably not true. Or at least not the whole truth. My guess is it's a combination of a complaint from a Bondi survivor and probably with a little bit of help from local pro-Israel groups. And I think the next step is to start being honest about these
these horseshit claims of anti-Semitism and what they really mean and what the goal of them really is. And then liberals got to stop this defensive posture where we take any of this at face value, because it's obviously a playbook. It's a formula. It's a script.
One last thing. More journalists have been killed in Gaza than in like all wars since World War II cumulatively. And you would think that media would take that seriously, right? Their brethren and sisters and so forth.
No.
And they've been pretty much silenced. Has there been any newsroom, anybody addressed this, the fact that journalists are actually being targeted and, you know,
no. What is it? Not in any sustained, meaning, not in any sustained or meaningful way. Like CNN had, I think, one piece. But again, it's always in the Hamas-Israel war. It's never seen as a deliberate practice by Israel. I'll give you The Atlantic magazine, right? Run by our favorite IDF prison guard, Jeffrey Goldberg, has run, I think by my last count, 13 articles on Hassan Piker over the last couple months. It has run zero articles in the last 3 years about death of journalists in Gaza. Not one. Literally zero. This was the epicenter of high-minded liberal journalism. So yeah, it doesn't fit the narrative. It makes Israel look bad in a kind of existential and illiberal way, which is why it's never talked about. To the extent to which it is touched on, it's framed as they're Hamas terrorists or ties to Hamas. This is the kind of crap that the free press pushes that has been now adopted by CBS. They kill poets and journalists and writers in their beds at night with their whole families. They did it for months for professors, journalists, doctors, leading politicians, academics, secular, doesn't matter. This is why the word genocide is used by every major human rights organization, because to maintain any credibility, they have to come to that determination. Because in addition to the systemic killing of people and making life impossible in Gaza through mass starvation, they've committed scholasticide. They've committed mass killing of creatives and artists, soccer players. So it's the wholesale destruction of society, because it's about, again, about the moral effect. It's about sending a message. Never, ever try to question our power and authority ever again. And we will just keep punishing you until you submit and duly humiliate, as the other half of the Palestinian population, from their perspective, not in reality, but from their perspective, has done in the West Bank. They want to kind of occupied, divided, segmentized people. And so the disgusting journalists being killed in mass doesn't fit that narrative. It messes it up. And so we just don't talk about it. And to the extent to which it's mentioned, it's given this two cameramen killed in Gaza amidst war framework. And maybe they'll talk about it, but it's certainly not a narrative. It's not a breathlessly moral crisis like campus anti-Semitism, for which we get nonstop coverage on. I'll give you one last data point, because I just talked about it yesterday on Twitter, which is for the first 6 months of the genocide, anti-Semitism was mentioned in the New York Times, Washington Post, CNN.com, Axios, Politico, AP, as standalone mentions, 1,385 times. And Islamophobia, which was, according to the own university studies, was roughly equal to that of anti-Semitism, was only mentioned 22 times. So you got a 63-to-1 ratio. One is a narrative. One is an urgent thing we have to do something about, right? We need to take action, which is to say suppress free speech and break down the camps and kick people off campus and get people fired and ruin people's academic careers. And the other is just this thing we kind of box check, but it's not a narrative. And that's really the issue. So we say on our show all the time, the atomic unit of propaganda is not lies, it's emphasis. It's the urgent, breathless narrative. Like, when do you see a politician get grilled with multiple questions on CNN? Truly, you can quantify this for an issue other than their commitment to Zionism. It is the only time you see a politician get grilled with three or four questions on CNN. Literally. Maybe the occasional kind of funding bill here and there, or like hypocrisy thing. But again, El Sayed cannot have an interview where he's not given three to four questions. And I detailed this, where he's grilled about Israel's right to exist, right to defend itself. You have fucking struggle sessions. And you just don't get that on things like, do you think people should die of preventable disease?
They don't ask that question if Americans have the right to defend themselves against ICE.
But I suppose that's not really in dispute, right? But yeah, they don't. Yeah, that's better yet, El Sayed responded by saying, because he's always asked, do you think Israel's a right to exist? He says, why do you never ask me if Palestine is a right to exist? Normative question. It's not a descriptive question. So you should, in theory, be asking every Zionist if they think Palestine has a right to exist, especially those who claim to support a two-state solution. And I looked it up, and the media mentions in the last 10 years, for Israel's right to exist is 2006, And the total mentions, media mentions, and the five major outlets I studied for Palestine having a right to exist was five. So these struggle sessions, these ideological grillings just don't happen for pretty much any other topic but this topic.
I do want to do a shout out to this left media ecosystem, which has actually created something of a counter narrative here, which I think is important, sure. Which you talk about at the end of your book, plus the people on the streets all over the world and in the encampments and the universities in 2024 and beyond. But we're also at time. So, well, last question is, where can people find your book? I think it's also important to note that all the proceeds from your book, all the royalties from your book are being donated to the Middle East Children's Alliance. But tell our audience where they can get
your book. Yes, and they're in Berkeley, California, where you are. Exactly. The book can be found at any bookstore, really. It's actually got decent distribution. Even some Barnes & Nobles have it.
And you can borrow at a library in Australia.
No, Jackson. And you can go to the Waverly Library in Australia. Actually, it's on back order. There's like 28 reserves.
Great. They gave you free publicity.
They did, but like it's the Streisand effect, and it's like, A, I don't make any money off the book anymore. I got paid.
Yeah.
So it's, but also B, like, it's to the extent to which that banning has utility, I think it's actually a good demonstration of how to interrogate these bullshit mopey stories they tell. So I think that's going to be its utility at the end of the day. But it can be, yeah, whatever. The evil corporation, it's there. You can get it from Pluto Books directly, which I think the publisher always prefers. And local independent bookstores usually have it, though not always. The one near my house doesn't. I didn't say anything. I'm not mad about it. I'm a little bitter. I got to go to Pilsen. But anyway.
You can catch Adam on book tour too, where you can buy it, which is where I got it.
I'm done touring for now, but I may do some spot stuff here and there because the book is doing well. So the publisher is willing to send me out. But I got two kids. It's like hard to travel.
Yeah.
Yeah. Anyway. Yeah, no, you can see it. You can definitely see it at miscellaneous bookstores, and that's online at a bunch of shops too. And of course, get it from your library.
Folks, we've been talking with Adam Johnson, media analyst, co-host of Citations Needed, and then author of How to Sell a Genocide, The Media's Complicity in the Destruction of Gaza. If you like what you're hearing, please check us out on Facebook, Instagram, Twitter, and Blue Sky. If you're watching this on YouTube, hit that subscribe button. And if you really like us, go to greenredpodcast.org and hit the support button. Become a patron at patreon.com/greenredpodcast. Adam, it's been great having you here today. And everybody else out there, make trouble and misbehave, and we'll talk to you again soon.
Thank you. I appreciate y'all.